Hi, my name's Adrian Chad. I'm giving a talk today on writing network services. Just a quick bit of background on myself. I've been programming since I was this high. I've been writing Squid, I've been modifying the Squid web cache since I was about this high. I've been I've been working on Squid since I was 1997, 98. I mostly work on the storage side and the network side. So today I'm going to be talking about network-specific stuff. What I will cover, paradigm is such a bad word for that. I'm going to describe the basic types of network services, network servers that you'll come across, some I/O models, what you'll come across when you're writing them, optimizations. Bits to make it faster, bits that make it slower. Some of the issues that you come across, that I've come across to try and save you all 7 years of hell. And if I've got any time left at the end, I'm going to quickly step through writing an example, well, speccing out an example server on the whiteboard so people can have some insight into what I do at least whenever I'm actually writing a network service. What I won't cover, I don't believe in lots of examples. Google is such a really nice tool that if you wanted backup figures and codes that you can compile, you can just go there. I'm not going to talk about whether Windows or FreeBSD or Linux are better than each other. I'll point out what does what, but it's up to you guys to implement it these days. Machines are quite fast, so there's no real advantages to running it on anything. It's up to how good you code. And any actual proof, I'm like one of those university lecturers, you know, or book authors. The proof of this is left to the reader. The basic network paradigms or the basic types of services you'll come across. The very, very simplest one is a single process server. Oh, sorry. I assume you all know what a computer is and have some basic understanding of coding. I'm not going to go into lots of detail about coding. Again, if you're a coder, you might find the beginning of this talk a little boring, but it should get better near the end. The simplest type of network service is a single process that just handles one connection at any one time. It's very easy to write, it's very easy to debug, but it's slow. A good example of this would have been the very, 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 very earliest web servers coming out of NCSA, or CERN, the really test ones. The very first web server handled one request at any one time. It's very easy to go from that one to this one. The difference between this one and the previous one is instead of one process handling one request and then handling the next request and then handling the next request, you take that thing and every time a request comes in, you take a copy of that thing just to handle that request. So if there's a, is there a pen? Yeah, get one. So it's easy to go from the first one to the second, for the first one to the second one, because all you need to do is, instead of handling every request as it comes in and then handling the next one, you immediately handle the request, create a new thing to handle it, and then move on to the next request. A good example of this would have been SendMail or the early Apaches. The request comes in, you get a decent throughput, you get decent concurrency, but there are limits, especially on early machines back in like early to mid-90s when fork was copy all of my memory and continue. That took a bit of the edge off. And there are limits on how many processes you can run on machines. Well, there were limits. I hear Linux is fast at it now, but I'm not sure. It's really easy to go from the second one to the third one, where instead of having one thing that makes lots of copies of itself every time you want to handle a request, you have one thing that makes lots of copies of itself, and they just sit there. And every time a new request comes in, all of them jump up and say, me, and only one of them jumps high enough. So one child process wins the request. It's very easy to go from the code from the first one to the code from the third one because there's only about 20 lines difference. Everything else is pretty much shared. Over there. There's less overhead because these processes generally hang around and handle more than one request more than one request in a row because you've already got the code in there that accepts the request, picks up a request, does it, and then sits there and waits. So there's less overhead, but again, you need to have these processes sitting there. And again, lots of processes can kill a machine. A good example of this is the Apache 1.3 stuff. Then we get to threaded. Threads are like processes. except they're faster, and it's easy to screw up with them. The model's the same. You generally have one thread per connection, like one process per connection. Every time a connection comes in, you either give it to a thread that's there or you create a new thread. Creating and deleting threads is faster than processes. Scheduling threads are generally were faster than processes, so you get higher throughput on this, but it's very easy to completely screw up threads when you're writing them. So again, most programmers aren't very strict and can go for years before they start finding bugs in their code. The next one, which is what I work on, is multiplexed I/O. And the idea here is you've got one process that handles all the requests, but instead of it handling one request and then doing another one, it takes the request and chops it up into little bits, where those little bits are generally something to do with reading or writing to the network. I.e., if you're writing a web server, the bits that you can chop it up into would be get request, get incoming request, read the request, send the reply, close the connection. So each one of those four bits you chop up into a part, they can run within themselves quite quickly, but there could be significant delays between when you accept a connection and when you've read the request. So what happens here is you need to have some magic in the code that handles lots of these little chunks one after another. It's very quick because you don't have to worry about switching processes, switching threads, creating them, deleting them, managing them, but you have to be very strict about the way you program, otherwise it blows up in your face. It's kind of like cooperative multitasking. Any of you guys, anyone here who uses Mac OS 9 who's come across the idea? Yeah, any Mac OS 9 people here? Mac OS 9 is faster than Mac OS X because it's cooperative multitasking, but when one process dies, the whole machine dies. It's a similar sort of concept. Then we get to some twisted stuff like Apache 2. Anyone here run Apache 2? It's fast. It is. But when it dies, it kind of does die very, very nicely. The problem is, again, broken up into small units. But instead of you implementing all of this wonderful multiplexing logic, you treat it as if you treat in your code as if it's one process per connection, and this magical library that sits underneath you handles like multiplexing that I/O. Apache 2 does it, and it uses multiple processes or multiple threads on a machine in order to scale. And it's bloody quick, but you're limited to what the library does. And the library here is very strict. So if you want to develop something that's, well, very flexible, you might have issues doing it with that. Wait a second, I just talked about the wrong one, didn't I? Yes, I talked about that one there. The composite one, which is another twisted one, is how things like QML and PostFix work. You've got a problem, which is sending and receiving email, and SendMail handles it by one big process that handles everything, which is all fine and good, except when you want to try and audit it, or you want to add a new feature, and you can't, because you're stuck with whatever SendMail or PostFix give you, which is a lot, but they're big. Well, SendMail, it's a lot, but it's pretty big. So the QML and PostFix work by taking each part of the problem, i.e. sending a piece of mail, or queuing a piece of mail locally, or trying to, or running the queue over to see what's happening, delivering locally, whatever, they break it up into chunks, and then each chunk is a separate process, and they all talk to each other. It's limited in the same way as normal processes are limited, because you've got one process or a bunch of processes per connection, but because there's a lot of them, each one does a little tiny bit, so you can either replace them with your own, or you can stick processes in the middle. So from a development point of view, it's a lot more fun. From a security audit point of view, it's a lot easier to prove that it's actually secure, but it's still not really designed to be as high speed as the machine's capable of doing, and we've already done that. All right, now I'll talk about how you actually get these silly programs to do I/O. I/O is how, well, input-output is basically here, is either talking to the network or talking to disk. Most of the time, a network service is going to spend speaking all of it to a network, so you're trying to find a suitable way to talk to this other program sitting on a network somewhere. Now, under Unix, and I'm not going to really cover Windows because that'll take too long, Unix I/O is done using read and write. Read and write are very simple. You give them a file descriptor, which is a disk or another or a connection or a socket, and you just pass it a buffer, and it does stuff to it. It either sends it or it receives it. Buffers that are supplied are copied. You just keep that in mind when we go on it a little. And non-blocking I.O. can be performed, and we'll cover what non-blocking I.O. is in a minute. Now, simple and effective, but not terribly efficient, and a lot of network code ends up grabbing all these little tiny strings, like say you're creating a HTTP request. You've got four or five headers that are lines. Your code might have these four lines hidden somewhere not linked together, and then you end up copying them all into a buffer you can send out this one buffer to write. Or you end up doing multiple little tiny writes. So it's not really that efficient. The next type of I.O. that you get is scatter-gather I.O. And the idea here is instead of this, I get to draw, ha 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 ha. And these are lines that you want to write out to some random destination. If you want to do the normal write way, you'd either write them separately or you'd have to copy them into one big buffer. And you'd pass that on to write, which means you have to do a copy or three calls. If you want to do write v, you'd create this. And the idea behind this is you've already got these three things sitting in memory somewhere random, and you want to write them out. So instead of copying them all into a location, you create this little block here that says, I've got three bits, and it's here and here and here, write them all for me. So it's done in one call, and you don't have to copy anything. It's very useful in network services programming because you spend a lot of your time chatting to some other remote host using text. A lot of internet protocols are actually based on human readable stuff, rather than random strings of bytes. So because they're delimited by lines, you end up implementing a lot of stuff to handle lines in your program, and you want to take those lines and put them to the computer, and the computer doesn't really know what a line is. You can't send individual lines to another machine. It just wants a block. So out of those two possibilities, there are two ways of actually doing them. The first way is blocking I.O., where you want to do something where something is reading or writing, and you're prepared to wait for it to finish. This is really easy to use because, well, you're guaranteed when it returns, it's telling you, yes, I've either written it, no, I haven't written it, or I've only written this much before the other end of the connection said, I died or there was an error. So it's really simple to use, but you can only use it if you've got one process per connection because it's blocking. The whole process waits for you to finish that I.O. The non-blocking I.O. under Unix modifies the semantics a little, and it says, well, if I'm going to write something or if I'm going to read, I'm going to try and do as much as I possibly can without a blocking. So if there's space to send it to the other host, it'll write a bit and then say, I wrote this much, and then I had to stop. Which is good because it means that you can write this program that doesn't ever stop. It just keeps doing stuff, and you can throw things at different connections. But you have to track exactly what you're doing. So it adds a level of complexity. It adds a level of complexity, but it's a lot faster. The third way, which is really only useful for disks, is what's called POSIX AIO. Now, does anyone here not know what POSIX is? All right, POSIX is a bunch of people that get together and say, yes, this is a standard, it's all good. Unfortunately, like most standards bodies, they get about 80% of the way there, and then they forget how to make it useful. And POSIX AIO is a great example of this. There's this wonderful way of scheduling events to happen, i.e. you say to it, I want to read from the disk at this location, tell me when you're finished. So doing that is rather easy. But then it makes you go and check every one of them that's pending in order to find out whether it's ready or not. And if you've got 1,000 of them, every time you want to find out what's ready, you have to check every one of those 1,000. So it's really efficient for lots of large I.O., which is really what it was designed for. It was designed for streaming, say, MPEGs off hard drives and feeding them out a network watching movies or watching prawn off your network. But it's not really good for doing lots and lots of network I.O. So now that you know the basics of how you do I.O., or what options you've got to do the I.O., how you can do the I.O., now you need to figure out how do I know when this I.O. operations have finished. And there's a few ways that you can do this. If you're doing blocking I.O., it doesn't matter because it'll be finished when it returns. So you just write your code, and you can assume in your code when it finishes your read or write, it's it's finished or it broke. But if you're doing non-blocking I/O, which is what these are going to cover, you need to have some way of asking the operating system, I've got this pending, what's ready? The first one is select. And select is a really old interface where you give it a big array of bits, and each bit corresponds to a file descriptor. So if you've got 100 file descriptors open from 0 to 99, you'd give it an array of 100 bits set, which you'd think is nice and efficient because it's all bit operations and they're all nice and fast. But if you've got the file descriptor 0 set and the file descriptor 100 set, it's a bit array. There's no information telling you where in the array that bit is meant to be. So you have to pass it all 100. So you pass it bit 0 with one set, and then 98 bits of nothing, and then bit 99 set. So the limits on this is basically, the limits with select is how many open file descriptors do I have, and if you're running a single process with lots of them open, like a couple of thousand like Squid has, then it starts to slow down. If you've got two or three open, it's nice and easy to use. Then the SysV Unix guy said, that sucks, we're gonna do it differently. I don't think they said we're going to do it better, it's just we're going to do it differently. And they came up with Pol. And Pol is a kind of the same idea. You've got an array, but it's an array of structures. And each structure has file descriptor and what you want to look at. So if you've got two file descriptors, file descriptor 0 and file descriptor 100, you give it an array of two entries, the first entry being file descriptor 0, I want to look at read and writes. And then the next entry is file descriptor 100. And it gives you back that array with the bit set of what's actually completed, which you think would be good, and it is a lot better than select, but the trouble is if you've got a few thousand open file descriptors and you want to check all of them, you have to create an array of 1,000, send it across, get it back, check every one of them, and then go on your merry way, which can take a while. Then some guys in FreeBSD a couple of years ago said, that sucks, we'll do it different. So they came up with KQ. KQ is a generic way of getting the operating system to tell you when stuff's ready. Now, when stuff's ready doesn't have to be the network socket or file is ready. They've actually implemented stuff like the file has changed or the process has died. So people have actually used KQ to do stuff like replace the wait syscall in something like init or the tail. Instead of just keeping on trying to read the last bit of a file, you simply set up a KQ note saying, tell me when this file has changed, and then it reads the end of the file. But the bits that we're going to look at here are, how do you do I/O with it? And the way you do I/O with it is, if you've got something that you want to read and write, instead of always having to keep setting up this array, passing it, getting it back, and then doing something with it if it's ready, you just go to the kernel, here's a note that says, I want you to tell me when this file descriptor is ready to read, and you give it to it, and then you run away. And you come back like a few calls later and you say, what's ready? And it'll tell you what's ready. You don't have to keep passing it stuff to check. It'll tell you when it's ready. So you can quite happily fire off 10,000 things, and it'll send ones back to you whenever they're ready. And a fun graph that I remember, yes?
What happens when
the question is, what happens when 10,000 things complete and you've got 10,000 notes in the kernel? The way it's implemented under FreeBSD is stuff like the per socket entry has a note structure at the end of it. So you already have that in memory, that the structures grew by a few bytes, and then you just have a queue of things that point to these nodes. So it's quite efficient, and when you call k events to get back that list of events, you say I an array of 30 events, tell me what's ready. And if you keep passing it that, if it overflows, I don't know if there's a limit, but if you can set a limit to what notes can be set, but the notes are actually attached to stuff you've already opened, so there's no chance of you killing a machine by having lots of stuff ready, because, well, it's already opened. The machine would have died already. Did that answer your question, mostly? Okay. In reality, we found that network I/O on when you're talking to internet hosts is quite bursty because people's connections suck. You've got a server that's hooked up via 100 megabit Ethernet to a 2 megabit link going across the transatlantic link that is okay, and then someone's modem on the end of a dodgy ISP with a wet piece of string. So So when you write these network apps and you run them on your local network, it all works fine because the latency and speeds are nice and quick. And then you run it over the internet and you find that for your 1,000 concurrent connections, you end up having to buffer a whole lot more of data and you have packet loss and retransmission stuff. So I/O doesn't happen, I/O doesn't complete as fast as you'd think it would. So what you end up having to do is write a program that can can cope with the small amount of I/O that's coming in, but checking these huge numbers of file descriptors that are sitting around just waiting for stuff to finish. The fun graph that I was going to draw, I'll do it here, is this is time, and this is number of file descriptors. And with selected did this, with poll it did this, and with KQ it did this. It doesn't actually grow. They opened up 10,000 connections and it grew by this much. So for those of you who have done CS, it's basically an ON1 operation. It's quite nice and fast. But not to be beaten, because you want to run, the Sun wanted to have applications run fast on their machines as well. They came up with what I think was a hidden interface that they then published later on for us people who write open source software and can't afford a Sun license, called DevPoll. And DevPoll is kind of like KQ, except it's just for I/O events. So you've got this file that you send stuff to, and then you read from the file, and the file sends back to you what I/O events are completed. So for the most part, it's like KQ. It's a little less efficient, it's a little less flexible, but it does the job a lot better than Poll does. And then just to show that there's more than one way to skin a cat, the Linux guys came up with another absurd way of doing I/O, which involves real-time signals. And real-time signals under Linux are these things that you can attach things to, and these things are arbitrary and they're queued. And it's really hard. I'm not going to go into the way it works now, but it's fast, which is the whole point here. So you can get the OS to actually attach numbers which correspond to file descriptors whenever something's ready, and they just send it to you as a real-time signal. The limit is that there's 1,024 real-time signal available, so that's how many file descriptors you can check in one hit. I'm not sure of it anymore. I played with it a long time, like a couple of years ago. I think they may have made it a little more intelligent, but it's still a lot faster than Poll, so people use it. How am I going for time? All right. So now I've confused you with what options you have on writing the network side of stuff. We're going to have a look at how you'd actually sit down, how I'd sit down and attack writing a network server. Now, I've written a few of them in my time, and I've had to work on network servers that other people have written, so I've got an insight into how bad people are at coding, including myself. So it's basically in the next 10 minutes are going to be basic structured programming. All the stuff you're going to see is, but that's too hard. I don't need to go into that level of complexity. But later on, as we go on the talk, you'll kind of realize that it happens. First thing you want to do is sit down and go, what is this server I'm going to write? Is it going to serve, is it an ICQ server? Is it a new server? Is it an IRC server? What's the actual application? What will the server be doing? How flexible does this thing need to be? Will it suffice if it just, sends a response every time you send a packet? Do you want to make it extensible to handle different protocols? Do I need to invert external programs to do any of my work? How fast does this thing need to run? If it only needs to handle a couple of connections a second, you don't need to spend all this time writing this wonderfully fast application around it. You just have to write something crap in Java. whereas if you needed to be fast, then you've got to sit down and think, okay, what's the trade-off here? If it's going to be fast, do I want to make it simplistic or do I want to make it flexible? Pick one. Will it need to scale? Do I want this application to run on a machine that's got multiple processors? Do I want this application to run on bigger machines and scale linearly? Is it an I/O-centric application? I.e., is your application sitting there handling I/O coming in and spitting stuff out like a web server? Or is your application doing something else like, counting fish? And then when it's got a figure, spitting out the results to some other program? And finally, which language should I use? And the answer is not always C, contrary to the popular belief. The network side of writing network applications is quite simple. Everything sucks. People spend all this time writing RFCs that A, no one listens to, or B, they suck themselves. RFC 2616, which is a HTTP 1.1 RFC, is vague and evil and this thick. And I don't think anyone's actually written an RFC 2616 compliant web proxy on the planet because there's too much to do. So how much of this do you care about? depends entirely upon what you want to write. You're writing a basic web proxy, or you're going to try and handle all the historic evilnesses inherent in the thing. I mean, there's part of RFC 2616 which says, yes, this page costs this much money. Has anyone ever seen that pop up before? No, it's in there, but no one handles it. Not only does the RFC suck, but everyone else who writes software out on the internet doesn't get it completely right. So you kind of have to write your application sending stuff that you think is correct and hoping that people send you stuff that they think is correct and assuming that they're not going to. This is an important part because you'll spend a lot of your time trying to write software that's completely correct and then it doesn't work because everyone else out there has misinterpreted the RFC. So you then have to take your software and write it a little differently because the RFC was right, but everyone else is, well, writer, I guess. Designing the code, well, a combination of both of those silly management type descriptions of code design is I find the best. A top-down development is you look at the big picture and then you work down into smaller bits until you've written the program. Bottom-up design is you build these little tiny bits and you put them together until they look like what you're trying to do. I do both because they both have their advantages and disadvantages. Top-down is good for identifying what the actual problem you have, the solution to the problem, and bottom-up. Top-down is good for identifying what the program needs to do, and bottom-up is good for identifying how you're actually going to, what you can build to start with, and build that up to look like what your solution is, and you meet about halfway. You want to be breaking up these bits of code into nice, simple, contained parts of the solution. You don't want stuff that where the dependency tree points everything to everything else. Which, funnily enough, tends to revolve around the idea of a connection, i.e. if you're writing a web server, it'll be the incoming connection. If you're writing a mail server, it'll be the incoming mail connection or the outgoing mail connection. Network IO-centric applications tend to revolve around this. Be prepared to handle every single error, everything. Who here's a programmer? Put your hands up. Who here checks the results of syscalls? Who here checks the results of all syscalls, including close? Close returns an error. It can return a SIG an interrupt, which means that I was trying to close you, but I got a signal and I was interrupted. One of the bugs in Squid, yes? Yes. We've got that. We had that problem in Squid. We'd slowly leak file descriptors over the course of 3 or 4 months. Up until about a year ago, Squid kept dying every couple of days or so, depending upon how much load you put on it. And then we suddenly fixed all of the crashing bugs. Found that it was leaking things like memory and file descriptors. And we fixed the memory bugs. And the file descriptor leak was we forgot to check close. I never thought about it before, but I read the man page and it's there. Be aware of when you create and delete things, because one of the biggest problems that people have when they're writing any sort of application is they'll forget to track when you create and delete stuff, and you end up losing them. You've got to keep track of where everything is. You only want to do it once. And that'll pop up in a minute. Well, it'll pop up when I do the demonstration on the whiteboard. Regression test suites are your friend. If you've written these nice little modules, you want to be able to test every one of these nice little modules to match what they're meant to do. Because when you've got one little module and it doesn't work, it's fine, it doesn't work. When you've got 40 or 50 of them all working in the same program and they're all trying to handle this stupid amount of traffic, if you've got one bug in one module, how do you know which module it's in? And here's the fun bit that we had in Squid. What happens if people start writing code depending upon the undefined behavior of some other module? People do this quite often, and it's kind of fucked up to try and, it's kind of messed up to try and fix. David, did I swear? Oops. All those under 18s, go out now. Trends, goodbye. Oh, I've just covered this, good. So the things that you're going to hit when you're going to write a network application, which if you've been paying attention, you'll start to realize that I'm tackling big, fast network applications that run forever and need to be long-lived. They need to be long-lived, they need to handle stupid amounts of traffic and be flexible and not die. So it's coming down to a lot of basic programming techniques, formal testing, formal proving, et cetera, et cetera. Memory allocation. One thing that people really, really, really like doing under Unix is writing lots of code that does malloc of lots of random sizes. And the trouble is that malloc, being the thing you call to get memory from the library, the kernel, isn't good at random sizes. It's good, it's okay, but it's not designed to be called lots and lots and lots and lots of times, and so things leak. It's a general solution for a very broad problem. So you end up implementing your own memory allocation system, because things like connections or buffers have a fixed size, whether it's 30 bytes or 4,000 bytes. So people have come up with this thing called slab allocators or memory pools. And the idea is, instead of grabbing a block of 30 bytes, you'll grab 1,000 blocks of 30 bytes in one hit, and then your memory allocator will just hand out these 30-byte blocks to your program, and therefore you don't leak memory. Well, you don't leak memory much, because the malloc is good at handling large allocations and not good at handling lots of little small ones. The next thing that we always screw up when we try to write things that's fast is we B0 everything. We take a block of memory, and the first thing we do is zero it. And then the next thing we do is we write something into it. So we've just zeroed this block of memory for no really good purpose, which is all nice and good until people start relying on the fact that a block of memory they're getting from an allocator is zeroed. And then they write all this code assuming that the structure has all these null pointers and zero values in the code, in the structure, which doesn't hold if you're trying to pull the zero out and make the code faster. So the one thing that I look at every time I write something, a big network application, is I assume that the memory I'm getting from my allocator isn't zeroed, and if I need to do it, I do it myself. Most of the time, I find when I'm writing stuff, I'll grab some bit of memory, and then I'll fill it with values, and then I'll use it. What do I need to zero it for? The answer is debugging, but I don't do any of that, so it's all right. This debugging framework thing. The thing that people seem to do is they write this wonderful application, and then pull all the debugging statements out before they ship it, which is great until the code doesn't work anymore. Or they'll write this nice application and then fudge all the debug stuff into it and it doesn't really do exactly what it's meant to do. So I've spent a bit of time implementing a debugging framework which was mostly ripped from Squid, and I use it everywhere that I can, absolutely everywhere, because you can always turn it off. But if you don't have enough of it, trying to find problems can be a bit of a pain in the butt. Scheduling I/O. You want to pick which model is suited to your task. If you're trying to write an application that's really busy, have a look at either the Apache 2 style hybrid model, or have a look at the multiplexed I/O model that we play with Squid or the ISC server. If you're trying to write an application that reports the temperature every minute to some other program, it can run out of INetD. You don't have to do anything special to write this program. So pick something that is flexible, suited to your task, but it needs to be flexible, because if you want to take that temperature monitor and, you know, have it serve 30 hits a second, it can't run out of INetD anymore. So don't be afraid to be flexible, but change your application later on to suit another model. Optimistic I/O can be a good thing. If you've got, 10,000 file descriptors, it's really stupid to ask every one of them, can you please, when are you ready? Think about when you talk to someone. Okay, how many people call into overseas? Okay, when you call overseas, do you notice how sometimes only one person can speak at a time, or sometimes there's line noise, there's artificially generated noise and stuff? It's because the phone companies, they said, okay, we're gonna give everyone this nice 64 kilobit channel to put, the bidirectional channel to put data over. And then they realize this costs so much, so let's only give them 32K by compressing the data, so they fit twice as many phone calls in. And then they realize that people only speak to each other half duplex. So they said, fine, we'll only give them half duplex. That means we can fit 30 people in the space of one old phone call. And so what if you can't hear them, you can't hear both sides of the conversation? Most of the time, people aren't going to be speaking at each other unless they're divorcing. So optimistic I/O works in that principle. You might have a file descriptor that's open that you're receiving email from, but you're not always going to be ready. You don't always need to read stuff from it. Say you're doing the chatter, mail from receive to data. When it's sending stuff to you, you don't have to wait until it's ready to write out, do you? You can ignore that until it's finished sending you data, and then you say, when is it ready to be written out? It takes a little more logic, but it means that you only register for file descriptors that you know you're going to get something from pretty soon, and it cuts down on how much of the OS time you spend looking to see whether it's ready. Basic interaction with the kernel. These syscall things that you need to do stuff. They're okay when you're doing a few of them a second, but In some of my busy Squid servers, we're doing 30,000 or 40,000 syscalls a second. And on something like Solaris or the Alpha, it's nice and quick because they've got this magical syscall instruction. Oh, sorry, in the MIPS. But on the PC, it does suck. You have to go into kernel space, save the stack, go to the kernel, blah, 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 restore stack, switch to user space, continue. And that needs to be implemented in most of a bit of it in software. So you want to minimize the amount of syscalls you need to do. You don't need to call the get time of day function every time you do a piece of IO. Do it once a second. It doesn't change that often. High transaction servers shouldn't be process-based. All these people out here that run Apache to serve images are really stupid. I've unfortunately been involved in running some very, very busy image-based sites that run on Apache 1.3, and they get slaughtered because Apache needs to handle one process per connection that's bringing 1,000 bored men looking at them. So you replace it with something that's tailored towards that solution, like something like ThTIP or Boa, which is really good at serving lots of static content, and all of a sudden your load average on your machine drops. Like on one of my one of the sites, it was able to serve like 80 megabits of traffic, and the machine was still running X nice and responsively. It was quite scary. Use your cache efficiently. A lot of people who write software cache stuff in memory that the kernel could do for them quite well, especially stuff coming off disk. Your kernels are pretty good at caching this disk stuff. You don't really need to tell it very often when to do it for you. Things like Oracle, if you're writing a database, maybe you want a raw disk device and implement your own caching, but people forget that, you know, the kernel's doing it for you, or buffering your network stuff. Just send network stuff to the kernel and give it large buffers. You don't need to try and keep 64K of data for every connection you've got when the kernel's gonna do it for you anyway. This was different in like Solaris, Sunos 4.1.1 days on Spark 2s, but these days, you know, you've got grunt. Use layered storage techniques. Guys, memory isn't zero cost. One thing we've noticed when writing software is people write lots of software that just uses as much memory as it wants, and then it goes into swap, and then it spirals down into death. So look at when you're writing your any application, but network stuff generally is going to be trying to get stuff off disk, or in the case of Squid, it has this index in memory of all the objects, which is really stupid these days because disks are nice and fast. So say, what do I need in memory? What can I put on disk? And how can we use this more efficiently? And everything starts running better. Indexes on disk are a big thing. There are plenty of really, really well-known techniques for putting indexes on disk-type media that can be cached really efficiently. I'm not going to go into them because I don't know any of them, but I'm sure that they're there. It's that thing I'll learn in second year or third year uni when I'll get to it. Memory bus isn't zero cost either. I don't know how many people spend all their time b-copying buffers of data around and then wonder why their application is really slow. And the answer is, on the machine, even on PCs these days, you've got a 500 megahertz memory bus, but if you're copying this 4K buffer 10 times, you've wasted, you know, 10 times the amount of memory bus capacity. But it's not just that, it's also stuff like, it's gonna copy the stuff on and off the disk and in and out of the network card. And the kernel is gonna take a copy of it when it wants to do work with it. So how many copies can you get away with when you're running a network program? Try to minimize the number of copies you get. You could draw the line at, you know, complexity versus flexibility. You know, if you want it nice and simple, you don't need it to be very flexible, then you can do zero copy easily. If you want it to be flexible, then you know, maybe you need one or two copies, or you want to make it look really complex. Tune your devices to minimize interrupts. Under Linux, for some bizarre reason, by default, DMA is turned off on IDE disks, which is really dumb. Because, you know, pardon? Okay, well, are you sure? Because even on some of the 2.4 machines, the 2.4 machines I've installed, that's defaulted to no DMA. Pardon? Yeah, like HD Palm lets you turn it on, but it doesn't seem to be on by default. And when you're putting lots of IO through a disk, the interrupt counts go up. And unfortunately, every interrupter needs to do something, and that piece of something gets slow when it's run 3,000 or 4,000 times a second. So when you're trying to build a busy network server, the first thing you do as a sysadmin is try to tune, make sure all the device drivers don't suck, and make sure that you've tuned stuff like gigabit Ethernet card interrupt stuff, turn on DMA on stuff, don't use Realtek drivers, all that stuff. so that the actual system won't spend all of its time dealing with really crappy drivers. So now I'm going to impart on you 6 years worth of screwing around with squid and the stuff that we screwed up. The first thing is, we shouldn't really fear being structured about stuff. It's great to sit down and just hack. But the best hacks develop into great big programs like databases that end up needing to be rewritten every so often, because the ideas you had to start with aren't the ideas you had at the end, aren't the things you needed 5 years down the track. So put in a little bit of flexibility and don't be afraid of rewriting it. When you're building these modules, when you're building all these little modules that fit together to make your program, make them loosely coupled. Don't make them rely upon each other a lot, because when you want to change one, if you need to change one down the bottom that everything else relies upon its behavior, you're screwed. Design all your APIs to handle errors. If you're ever writing a function that doesn't return a value, you've written it wrong. Including deleting an object, because, you know, if that fails, it can fail, you know. Don't be afraid to start from scratch. Pick the right language. Who here has written a network app? Who here has written in something other than C? My God. Cool. C can be nice and appealing and bloody fast, but you spend most of your time duplicating some object framework. You know, you write list iterators. You write garbage collectors. You do all this, you write templates, you do inheritance, you do all this crap that, you know, C++ gives you. Python gives you. Why bother trying to duplicate it all when you could pick a different language? And people might go, ah, but C++ is crap. Then don't use it all. C++ is what? The language spec is like this? But if you use all of this, then you deserve to get whacked, all right? I mean, with Squid 3, the Squid 3 rewrite, well, most kind of rewrite, we've basically taken all the C interfaces, made them C++, and then because everything is an object of some sort, converting them over to be classes is proving to be real easy, because we take all these functions, and the first parameter of every function is a pointer to some structure containing data that becomes this. And it works. So you might want to consider picking an OO language. Even Java is good at writing some network apps. Interpreter languages like Python and Perl can also be good. It depends entirely upon what you're trying to write. Again, though, if you're a Perl programmer trying to make a really insanely fast piece of code, don't write it in Perl. Yes, the API design we've covered. Regression tests, please. Handle every error you get, please. When you're creating and deleting things like connections, only have one way to get in and one way to get out. Very important, because then when you start drawing on a bit of paper how you delete things that rely upon other things, if they've got multiple ways of being deleted, you don't know which way you've taken, you can't possibly write code for all of them, and you end up, well, losing them. So now I'm going to take my foot out of my mouth and describe how I wrote a little test mail program. I wrote a network library which basically takes all the stuff that you saw and put it in a library so that I can develop it independently of all the applications that I've got. So as a test, I wrote a program that sends out mail. It sends out a lot of mail. I mean, I was melting, you know, like 5 or 6 machines running QML and PostFix on my laptop running on a little like 400 megahertz P3 laptop, and I was still running X in Netscape and it was swapping, and it still melted this mail machine, these mail servers, because my program was nice and simple and opened up like 10,000 connections, and all the machines' load averages went through the roof and they shut down. So we're going to just do a quick implementation on a whiteboard, and I hope I don't screw this one right up. And hopefully you guys get an idea of what goes through my mind whenever I write a network app, and you might think about it yourself when you're doing it. And this is going to be nice and quick, because my talk's about to finish. All right. You're going to write a program that sends out mail. So first thing it's going to get is it's going to get a list of email addresses, and each email address is going to have a list of MXIPs. That saves us doing DNS lookups. So the first thing you're going to get is something like send mail. All right? You got to be kidding. All right. I'll write a bigger one. All right, I'll just do diagrams then. It's going to be sending a piece of mail. So you can take this thing of how am I going to send a piece of mail? I'm going to try and connect to each IP in that MX list until I get one that says yes or until I get one that says no. If a temporary failure, fine, ignore it, move on to the next one. It's not spam. If it's a permanent failure, reject it. If you can't connect, then just assume the host is down and move on to the next one. So what you need, you need something that sends mail. And you can all move down closer later on if you want. And it needs to have something that queues . So this thing here says to this thing here, I want you to send this piece of mail. And this thing here says, okay, well, I've got this piece of mail, this email address, and this list of IPs. I'm going to try something per address. So this thing here speaks to the actual SMTP talker. And this thing here does the I/O. So if these things here are individual objects, and the only thing that this thing takes in is an email address, and the only thing it ever spits out is it's completed or not, this thing here takes a list, an email address and a list of IPs, and it says, okay, I'm going to see if this works. The only thing it spits out is it worked or not. If this thing here takes an email address and a single IP and returns back up whether it worked or not, it can each module here can be individually tested, and you can start building bigger things upon it. I'm not going to have the time to actually sit down and describe how it all works, am I? Crap. Yeah, but I don't have the code on me. Is anyone interested in how this works? All right, what I'll probably have to do is put it online then. How many people want me to put it online? How many people will not spam with it? Oi! I can't, because I actually have to go to a dress-up party. No, but it's a tunic. No. Yeah, any of those? No, because it's bad. Yes, I've been working with it with a couple of UCC members. I'll eventually make it public. The issue with it is I'm just not happy with it yet. It works for all the stuff I want to do, but it's missing large chunks. I'll get around to it. Keep bugging me. No, because someone then will write something that sends lots of spam, and I'll be targeted for hate mail for the rest of my life. Questions? No? Good. Lots. No. The problem is so big that you end up having all these separate little frameworks to do stuff that only solve a specific problem. And mine solves a specific problem. I'm writing a server that runs as a single process doing multiplexed I/O. So it solves the problems the way I want it to be solved, which is fast and in C. It may not suit your problem. So there are lots of ways of doing it, but it comes down to, do any of them match what you're trying to write? Most people write their own anyway. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, that's fine.
Good. Damn Mike. I'm going to put this online with the rest of my talks. I keep a website there's about 6 or 7 talks on there on various subjects. So if anyone's interested in the slides and some of the notes, I'll put it up there.